everybody, and this is the spot usually on most retreats in which people start falling asleep, and I will not be offended if you fall asleep. Okay, so you've eaten something, you've had something to eat, you've enjoyed yourself, and I hope I won't bore you too much. Okay, so this is a fairly short talk, but it's on one of my increasingly favorite subjects, on sort of kindness as a form of wisdom. My name is Nanda Raja, and Yanavacha, who gave me my name, it can be translated as sort of king of all joys. So it's both a kind of aspiration and as a sort of quality that he saw in me that could, you know, could be developed into the ultimate form. When I started 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have courses called Who Hate the Metabhavana. You know, we had to sort of work it out all by ourselves. And what I like to do is just share some of my experiences and some of the tricks I use to make the Metabhavana work for me. And I'm hoping it may work for you. And if it doesn't, just ignore it and find your own way. That's the most important thing. Find your way through the practice. Well, so what I'm hoping is that, you know, maybe you can cut 5 or 10 years off your practice and just... I just want to start with a period of reflection. And I just want to ask a question. And there's no right answers, but... the question I want to ask is, and to make it easier, if you write it down, so you can sort of pin it down, what offends you? What offends you? So what offends you? Whatever the answer is usually a reflection that the difficult person or the enemy stage of the Metabhavana brings up. And that's why nowadays when I sort of teach and practice the Metabhavana, before I go into the difficult person, I can spend about 3 or 4 minutes just getting my body ultra relaxed. Because if it isn't, that person is going to be responsible somehow for the fact that there's traffic on the road, or my leg is itchy or whatever. You know, just thinking about that, you know, sort of brings my shoulders up and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of I need to sort of really ground myself both physically and emotionally before tackling the difficult person. Okay, so it just depends on the level of difficulty of the difficult person, you know. But I like a challenge, I found that difficult people have a direct physical response on me. And so before I do that, I need to really check where I'm coming from. Because if I'm already tense and irritable, then they're just going to add to it and they'll be the scapegoat. Yeah. But if I'm not totally, but fairly relaxed, I can sort of catch what's going on and I can sort of take some of the responsibility, because all that's happening is I'm bringing them to mind in my head. They're not physically there, but just bringing them to mind, you know, just can have a physical response. And some of the sort of physical response for me sometimes is maybe a coughing fit, you know. And that usually means there's something I want to say to them, and I've been holding it back because I've been scared, okay? But now that I'm in a face, in a safe environment, it sort of comes up and sort of disturbs my meditation, yeah? Or I will experience certain pains. So we have sort of nice words for it, like you say somebody, it's a pain in the neck. Well, in my meditation, you literally have a pain in the neck when you bring them up. Or you have a pain in the back, and then, oh, it's a backstabber, isn't it? Yeah. But, you know, the sort of the physical response is for me can be a cue as to what's really going on, rather than I'm trying to be nice and trying to empathize with this difficult person. So intellectually, something's going on, but physically, that's where the real honesty is. And I have to sort of come back, so this is what's really going on. I'm trying to be nice, but I'm not. So, coming back to the question, what offends you? So in Buddhism, there's a term called wrong views, and we all have views. And the nice thing about views is that they're almost invisible. But what makes your view visible is the difficult person, because they don't share your views. Yeah, they don't share your views, and because they don't share your views, they challenge your views. And then, for me, it's a kind of, how do I hold my views? Do I hold them tightly, or do I defend them? And the more I defend them, the more painful it is. I'm bringing them to mind, and then certain thoughts appear in my mind, and then depending on the thought, there's a physical response. And what I'm trying to do, well, what I'm doing in the metabhavana, is sort of notice the physical response, and then in spite of that, wish them well. And then I sort of feel the pain, breathe through it, and then wish them well again. And just sort of keep doing that. And the real challenge is that after a while, things shift. And what tends to shift is the way I think about that person, or the way I think about myself, the self-image that I'm protecting, that is the source of the clash. Okay. So, when I first started doing the metabhavana, I really sort of didn't do it. I just did the mindfulness of breathing during the metabhavana teaching classes, you know. And then when I sort of actually did do it, I noticed that my mindfulness of breathing improved. And what happened was, well, I was treating myself as the enemy. Yeah. So I have one of what people tell me is my good qualities is I can be fairly determined, and I can just sort of keep pushing, push through in order to make things work, yeah. And I'm fairly sort of clever, so I'm always looking for different ways, you know, to succeed. Well, the practice sort of brought me to myself. I suddenly realized, well, it slowly dawned on me. It wasn't suddenly, it slowly dawned on me that actually I didn't like myself that much. And that I kept justifying why I shouldn't like myself. And a lot of the justifications were just stories I've heard from my parents and people around me, just views that I just absorbed without really being conscious about them. And they just sort of seeped in. And because they were so regular and habitual, I just thought they were normal. You know, I didn't see that those thoughts were toxic, they were actually poisoning me. Yeah, and then it sort of suddenly made sense, you know, that maybe I wasn't the only the only person who didn't like themselves. My mother is a Christian, and there's the saying, love thy neighbor as thyself. Yeah. And what if you don't like yourself? Well, you'll treat your neighbor just as you treat yourself. And it sort of suddenly dawned me, in this crazy world, there's a lot of people that don't really like themselves. And they don't like other people. And it kind of makes sense, I sort of started seeing correlation that, you would hear somebody, talking about somebody else in a very angry way. And they will be telling you how angry the person was that they were talking about. And that's why they were having difficulties with it. you hear somebody gossiping about other people, and they will be gossiping about how the other person is a real gossip, and they don't really like that quality. And then I suddenly realize I'm a hypocrite. I keep complaining about other people being hypocrite, but actually I do that quite a lot. I let myself off the hook, and then I have a different standard. When I do something, when I'm late, it's because I just have so many things going on. But when other people are late, it's because there's something wrong with them. those kind of mental sort of battles, I have to sort of clock them and then sort of work with them. And of course, one of the biggest difficulties is the idea of empathizing with the enemy. So, empathy for me sounds, fairly soft, I don't do empathy. I can't do it, but it has to be somebody I like or somebody in the family, But, if you really come at me, you deserve what you get. And then sort of really turn it up to myself. That's how I treat myself. When I try to do something and I fail, I can spend months, just beating myself up. And why am I beating myself up? Because if somebody did it, I would do that. I would keep reminding them, of what they did wrong, why they did it wrong, and what they should do. And it doesn't help. And then when it didn't help, I just think, I just have to say more. that will make it work. And then I have to sort of stop, I have to sort of clock, I'm doing it again. This thought arises, I've been self-critical, and I just need to let that go, accept I've made a mistake, accept that people are fallible, accept my parents are human beings, accept my brothers and sisters, and do not exist to annoy me. They have their life of their own. And accept that my boss is suffering. And that there's nothing kind of special about that. And mostly accept that life isn't fair. For me, running through the metta-bhavana practice can be, in my mind, what I call, I call it the Machiavellian mind, the mind whose basic premise is, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? That's what drives it. What's in it for me? I'll be kind. But what's in it for me? And if there's nothing in it for me, why am I doing it? So why am I doing the metta bhavana? What's in it for me? And for a lot of time, there wasn't a lot that was in it for me. It was more of a, why don't you try it out? You've done the mindfulness of breathing. You know it has an effect. You can take a bit of confidence in that. Okay, you don't have the experience of doing the metta bhavana, but why not give it a try? Give it a serious try and see what happens. Okay. So that sort of what's in it for me, it's what comes up for me as sort of mixed motivation. So, you know, I can be sort of nice, but I know it's mixed, you know. There's a level of niceness in it, but underneath there's probably a what's in it for me. And I noticed that because what's in it for me when I do something kind and people don't appreciate it. Yeah? And then I say, oh, that's why I was doing it. I wanted their approval. Or I wanted them to say, what a really nice guy. Yeah. Or even worse, you do something nice and then they slap you in the face and say, I didn't want it. Yeah. I didn't. You gave me this, I didn't want it. You didn't even ask me. You just thought you're doing what's good for me. Oh, right, okay. Oh, yeah, okay. I've been arrogant. I've been presumptuous. Oh, you know, just assuming without actually asking, you know. And that's why, in the metta-bhavana practice, I have to keep reminding myself, you know, what's the phrase usually is, may they make progress. And they have to add, on their own terms. Not progress, that makes me feel good. It's on their own terms, that progress for them. It's not about me. Yeah. Over the years in my practice, I've kind of played around with the metta-bhavana practice, and certain sort of pennies I've dropped. So a lot of this was before I got ordained. So when you get ordained into a Triratna, you're handed, instead of five precepts, you're handed 10 precepts. And usually we say those precepts in the Pali, in the sort of language that you don't understand. The five precepts we use is like to abstain from taking life, to abstain from taking the not given, to abstain from sexual misconduct, to abstain from false speech, to abstain from taking intoxicants. Yeah. So that's what, you know, in the puja, the sort of pana, tipata, or ardinadana, all those, you know, those are the precepts. And then there's sort of positive precepts with deeds of loving kindness, with open-handed generosity, with stillness, simplicity, and contentment, with truthful communication, yeah, and with mindfulness. But for the older members, there are sort of four speech precepts. So there's the false speech, yeah, to abstain from false speech, to abstain from harsh speech, to abstain from useless speech, to abstain from slanderous speech. And the connection with that, with a difficult person, is that sort of mentally, those are the things I'm doing. Yeah? Those are the, you know, I'm slandering them in my mind, I'm talking harshly to them in my mind, and then there'll be a period, I'm supposed to do the metta-bhavana. May you be well. But my mind goes up. Oh, you got this, and then may you be happy. And then there's the usual but. May you be happy, but. Yeah. You know, and so it sort of dawned on me. Oh, right, the difficult person might be a kind of mirror. A mirror that shows me where my blind spot is. Because if I'm doing that to the difficult person, maybe I'm doing it to myself, but I don't notice it. And if I'm harming and injuring myself without noticing it, then what's that about? Am I being really mindful? Yeah. And so what I'm doing now is, as I'm applying the speech precept to my internal dialogue. How do I talk to myself? How do I talk to myself? So, in the first stage, you know, I'm talking to myself and I'm wishing myself well, yeah? And then I'm remembering, oh yeah, I forgot this person's birthday.
May I be well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah, I really shouldn't have said that to my sister. Yeah. Yeah, it may be true.
Yeah.
But was it helpful? Yeah. So the truth is a double-edged sword. The truth is it cuts both ways. So not only must I be truthful to other people, but I must be truthful to myself and then take responsibility for the consequences. So with truthful communication, with kindly communication, with helpful communication, with harmonious communication. So in my self-talk, it authorizes and I go through a checklist of five, of examining that thought. So the thought comes, and immediately, oh, of course it must be true. Yeah, it's obvious it's true. And then I ask myself, is it true? Yes, of course it's true. Okay. If you were wrong, how would you know? And usually it goes blank because I only look for evidence that support my views. Yeah, I don't. If I was wrong, how would I know? And then sometimes it's like you ask, you know, if you pause, is it true? And then it's like, it's not really true. It's like, yeah, maybe under certain circumstances true, but it's not absolutely true. You know, that's not the whole story. Yeah. So all right. So I'm massaging the truth. You know, I'm not really being that totally honest. I'm just being partially honest and assuming that that's the whole thing. So by examining the thought, oh, is it true? Oh, and if I was wrong, how would I know? That's another question. And then another question is it kind? So it may be true, but is it kind? And again, a lot of my thoughts aren't very kind. They may be true, but they're not very kind. And what makes something kind is context and timing. Yeah. So telling the truth within a certain context and in a timely way actually allows other people to listen to the truth. Yeah. Just pounding it into them doesn't really work. It definitely doesn't really work for me. And I don't like it when other people, in fact, that's what a lot of difficult people do. They keep saying the same thing over and over again and thinking that if they say it often enough, I will just accept their views. And usually it actually works against them because time to switch off. Don't listen to them. Just watch their mouth move. And then if they attack, just listen for my counterattack. You know, I'm just figuring out what to say back rather than actually listening to what they're saying. And then, is it helpful? So, okay, it may be true, but is it helpful? Helpful to whom? Yeah. What's in it for me? So it may be helpful for me, but is it helpful to them? And if it's not helpful to them, why would they accept it? Yeah. So when I examine my thoughts, oh, okay. Yes, that criticism of myself is true, but it's not very helpful. You know, it doesn't lead me forward. It just keeps me going around in circles. And then the obvious one, is it harmonious? Is it lending itself to bring you together, or is it pushing you apart? So is my mind coming together, become whole, or is it splitting off into other fragments, other sub-personality? So certain thoughts, they're not harmonious. They don't bring you more together. You know, they're either isolating or offensive in a, I'm just being honest. I'm just telling you the truth. You can handle it, well, too bad. Yeah. So that's not very helpful and that's not lending towards harmony. Yeah. And then there's another one I add, which is it inspiring? The way I talk to myself, is it inspiring? And most of the time, it's not inspiring. Yeah, it's more, yeah? Or it's conditionally inspiring, but there's usually, there's a condition behind it, yeah? And so in the Metta-Bhavana, we're practicing unconditional loving kindness, not conditional loving kindness, yeah? But we have to start from where we are, yeah, with a condition, and then maybe we can expand the condition to increase it more until it's unconditional, yeah? So it's no good pretending it's unconditional. It's just, right, this is the conditions that I'm willing to be kind. And then I can expand. Well, what happens if I make it a bit bigger? Well, when I make it a bit bigger, that means including lots of uncomfortable other things in order to make it bigger. And so the discomfort is okay, yeah. But what happens is that, actually, I can take it. My mind matures, It's not that, what people say doesn't affect me, yeah, but I now have a choice as to how I respond and to when I respond, yeah, and to the context in which I respond. And I can actually just sit with it. I don't have to respond immediately. I don't have to react, and that gives me a bit more freedom, yeah. So if I can give myself the freedom, then I can give other people the freedom. If I give myself the freedom to be myself, just to be myself, then my experience is it gives other people the confidence to be themselves. And then if they say something, they know that they will be heard. They may not be agreed with, but I won't react. They don't have to be afraid of what they can say to me. They can be open. Yeah. And then if they get it wrong, they also know that because I won't react in the same way, it just changes the dynamics. It just changes the dynamics. So I think about a year or two ago, there were retreats at Kench Hill when Vajrasana was being rebuilt, and on the door of one of the of this kind of sitting room was the word "Before you act, think." And it had THINK. And I said, is it true? T. H, is it helpful? I, is it inspiring? N, is it necessary? And K, is it kind? Necessary. So for me, a lot of my thoughts during meditation are not necessary. Because I've had those thoughts before. They've gone round and round and round. I know where they lead. And so the act of sort of mindfulness in the Metta-Bhavana practice is noticing, is catching it. This thought, that usually leads me to irritation, anger, self-justification, blah, blah, blah. Oh, this thought, that leads to depression. Yeah. Oh, that thought, that leads to helplessness. That thought, that eventually leads to feeling like a victim. Yeah. Yeah, so, the various thoughts arise, and there's a kind of train of thought. And if you can sort of be mindful of each carriage of the train of thought, you can see, so this is what's happening. I get into a groove, and this leads there. I've been there before. Do I want to continue with that thought? I can stop it now. I can get onto a different train and explore that thought. And if I can sort of think each thought through to its logical conclusion and to the emotional impact and the sensation that arises due to those thoughts, then something happens. I can be a bit more conscious. Yeah. I'm not always allowing other people to push my buttons. The buttons are still there. It's just that they don't get any reaction anymore, yeah? Because I push them often in myself, that I know, it's not them doing it, it's they say something, and then I push the button, yeah? So they become the trigger, But, you know, if somebody say, slap your face, you have a choice. You can slap your face or you can't, or you don't. Yeah. But just because they say it doesn't mean you have to do it. Yeah. So in a similar way, you know, the way we use language is, you know, we can tell people this, and then the emotional reaction is because, for me, it's because you are doing all the stuff for them. You know, they say a certain word in a certain phrase in a certain way, and then kind of flashback to your mom or your dad and what they said and how you felt as a child, blah, blah, blah. And it just carries on, yeah? And then when you go, oh, right, that's what happens. But I'm no longer a child. I'm no longer a teenager. I don't have to. I can choose to behave differently. I can be aware of my feelings. I can be aware of the kind of automatic thoughts that happen and the consequences, you know, of that. And then I can take, be more conscious of my feelings, my emotion, and that's okay. It's okay to feel the pain because I can bear it, yeah. It's when I believe the thought, it's unbearable, or, you know, or I believe the thought, it's impossible or whatever, you know, I've kind of created a mental barrier against myself. Yeah. As soon as you say something is possible, impossible, you know, the way the mind works is it never questions it. You know, a lot of things were impossible until they were done. And then they become possible. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. You can take the advice from Alice in Wonderland, you know, always have a couple of impossible thoughts every day and see what happens. Yeah. So. So, then leading to that, you know, by examining our thoughts, then for me, the only conclusion that leads to is generosity and forgiveness. They're sort of interlinked. So being generous to myself, allowing myself to be flawed, and being generous enough to allow that and still to love myself, and then to extend that generosity to other people, you know, to allow them to be themselves just as they are with their faults. Yeah. Yeah, and to, yeah, and not to place so many conditions on them. It doesn't mean that what they do will not affect me, but that's the nice thing about generosity. It can go as far as you want. It can go as far as your imagination. And in the Metta Bhavana, we're working with our imagination. We're trying to be limitless. You know, we're sort of tapping into an infinite resource that we can. So we're not generating metta. We're tapping into metta and then redirecting it. That's how I like to think of it. Yeah. Otherwise, the metta bhavana practice becomes, oh, I don't feel any metta. I'm trying to drag metta out of my, out of myself. And then, oh, I haven't got it. I really don't want to give it to them. They really don't deserve it. But if you can think of it, you know, as something that's free-flowing, it's there, you know, all you're doing is tapping into it, you know, but it's infinite, so you don't lose anything by giving it away. and if you keep it all to yourself, you know, you're going to be overwhelmed. You know, so you might as well give it away. You know, and that's the kind of so that's the attitude I have towards the Metta Bhavana now, rather than a kind of limited resource that I have to mine and then I have to sort of dish out. You know, in a very intelligent way, so that, you know, I don't go short, or my friends don't go short. Yeah, yeah, it's more like, okay, it's all there. Yeah, there's enough for everybody. Okay, and if there isn't, you can always tap into something else. You know, that's a lot of other resources. It's not as limited as my imagination thinks. So, what happens when I forgive? Well, the first thing that happens physically is I feel a lot better. It's not fair. It's not fair to forgive, but it is helpful. It is kind. Yeah, it does work. Yeah, so it's not about fairness. So it's about, generosity. Yeah, it's just, and if you do put conditions on it, just be aware of the conditions you put on it, and that's what is restricting that sense of generosity. Yeah. So if you cannot be generous to yourself, it's much harder to be generous to other people. And then the objections to generosity. Ah, they'll think I'm soft. They're going to walk all over me. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, those are the thoughts that occur. In my experience, that doesn't happen. Because if you think about it, the other person is thinking, what's in it for him? Why is it be so nice? What's in it for him? So they're looking for, maybe, sometime in the future is going to call back and, say, oh, well, you did this for me and you owe me now. No, I don't want to owe you, And, and once they see that there's nothing in it for you, okay, they can relax a bit more, yeah? And similarly, the Buddhist spiritual practices, there's nothing in it for you, because what it's saying is there's no self anyway, there's no fixed self. So in the real sense, there really is nothing in it for you, because there's nothing there for it to be in it for. But on a more practical level, you can just say, well, it's not, the universe doesn't necessarily revolve around me, even though it appears to. So just as we may know that the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, it's actually the earth turning around, we still use the word sunrise, sunset, even though the sun never rises, the sun never sets. But it makes sense to think about the sun rising and the sun setting, because that's what it does. That's what it appears to do. So in the same way, we have a sense of self. There's no avoiding it. Even though we may know that there's no fixed self, it seems pretty fixed. But it does change. And then when it changes, it seems to change and then fix again. And then it changes and then fix again. And I keep forgetting, oh, right. I have changed, although it always seems I've always been like this all the time. Actually, I haven't, and my mum knows it. She's seen me grow up. She's seen me develop. Yeah. So that's what I have to share. Thank you very much.